Joel, you want to know something?
What?
Every now and then, say what the f***. What the f*** gives you freedom? Freedom brings opportunity. Opportunity makes your future. If you can't say it, you can't do it.
Welcome to Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast. I'm your host. My name is Franz. This is going to be a quick introduction because I'm getting ready for a few weeks of travel overseas. I'll tell you all about it when I get back. This interview today is with Andy Schell. Andy Schell is the producer of another podcast called 59 Degrees North, and the website is 59north.com. He has some interesting interviews on his podcasts. I recommend it. If you enjoy this podcast, you might want to listen to his as well. He's a really interesting character, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it as well. I did receive a couple emails, and I'm going to share one of them with you. It's from Richard. Richard, who wrote me a couple questions a while back, said, enjoyed catching up on your podcast again. Many thanks for answering my questions a few podcasts ago. Was really nice listening to the filmmaking couple that you interviewed recently, and I think is a very strong chance that I and many others will be fulfilling their sailing fixation by purchasing some of their DVDs. It's nice to discover a whole series of something that you love and have never heard about. I don't know whether you saw any of their free DVDs, which are available on YouTube. They are just excerpts. But there is one of them sailing down the canals through France, and unlike the other person you interviewed about traveling the canals who had shipped his mast separately, I could see that their mast was fixed to their boat. I'm not sure you will ask them if they fit the mast themselves or if they used a professional. Looking forward to your next installment, and obviously looking forward to listening to many more interviews with the filmmaking couple. Take care, Richard. Yeah, Richard, I do plan on interviewing Paul and Cheryl Shard as much as I can. As long as I can get good new entertainment and information from them, I'll keep talking to them. And by the way, if you want to get any of their DVDs, if it's something you're interested in purchasing, I think they offer the full series, which I think is around 50 films, for $99. I'm not sure how many films there are, but there are a lot of films that they've put together. This is how they support themselves, by making these DVDs. And you don't have to buy the DVDs. You can stream it. And in fact, I'm streaming the DVDs through Vimeo. I think it's cheaper to do it that way. I think the Vimeo streaming is $99. If you actually want the physical DVDs, I think they're going to cost you a little more. But at home, I use Roku and high-speed internet and watch them just right on my TV. It's really convenient. But just a heads up, if you do want to get any of their films, I have a link at my website, medsailor.com. And if you click on that link and go to their website and buy anything from them, I get a commission. Regardless, you're going to pay the same amount, but I get a commission if you use the link at my website. Just saying. You don't have to, but if you do, I do get a little bit of a commission for the referral, I guess is the way you would say it. But I've enjoyed their videos that I've watched. They've been several places, actually quite a few places in the Mediterranean, especially in the Eastern Mediterranean that I haven't been. So I'm catching up on that, and I haven't watched their canal videos yet. But anyway, I forwarded on Richard's email to Paul Shard, and he responded both to Richard and me directly. He said, yes, Richard, we fitted the mast ourselves. I built the horses to hold it at the local lumber yard in Le Havre. And that's spelled H-A-R-V-E. A bit at the last minute, as we had understood that we could have trucked it, it turns out that they couldn't. We filmed the process of dropping the mast with a professional crane and operator in Tancarville, and that's spelled Tancarville, up the river from Le Havre, as part of our Season 9 programs. Best regards, Paul. All right. It's nice to put people in contact with each other. The quick advertisement, and it's going to be quick. If you're interested in any audio courses on helping you learn how to sail and prepare for the written portion of the ASA 101 or 103, I have some audio lessons that are available at the website, medsailor.com. Also, the ASA 101 course is available in iTunes and Amazon, and the title of it is Sailing! Exclamation point. Learn to Sail, Basic Keelboat Certification, ASA 101. That's available in iTunes and Amazon. And it'll be Sailing, Learn to Sail, Basic Cruising Certification, ASA 103, when it's available in iTunes. Or you could just search my name, Franz, F-R-A-N-Z, Amason, A-M-U-S-S-E-N, and you should be able to find them that way. All right, with that out of the way, let's get on to the interview with Andy. I'm talking to Andy Schell. He's the producer of the 59 North podcast, and he also has a website by the name of 59 North. Andy's a young guy. He's only 30 years old. He and his girlfriend or wife, which one is it, Andy?
Wife, yeah. We've been married for 3 years now. 3.5 years, actually.
Okay. They're, his wife is from Sweden, I guess, and they go back and forth between the United States and Sweden. And as you might understand from the name of the podcast and the website, he's not sailing in the Mediterranean. He's a northern water sailor. But like all sailors, I'm sure he has some great stories to tell. Thanks for joining me, Andy.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Franz. This is cool.
All right, now you can do your introduction, and then we'll just start talking. How's that
awesome.
Sound?
Yeah, so what I like to start with, I don't really do much of an introduction in the beginning, but I like to start by asking the guest simply to describe the setting. So, Franz, if you will, please, what's the setting like where you're talking to me from?
Well, I live in Salt Lake City, but I sail 2 months a year in the Mediterranean. I built my boat here, sailed up in the Northwest for about 5 years, and then I sailed it across the Atlantic, and I've been sailing in the Mediterranean ever since. That was 97. So I go away. I go over there for 2 months a year. The rest of the time, I'm just at a regular day job.
Okay, cool. And what kind of boat do you have?
My boat's a Bristol Channel Cutter.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's a nice, traditional, heavy-duty boat.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. I'm jealous.
It's a Lyle Hess design, and there's several Bristol Channel Cutters out there, depending on where you get your boat. But mine's a Lyle Hess design. I bought the fiberglass from Sam Moores at Sam Moores Company in Costa Mesa, California, the hull and deck, and then took 5 years to finish out the boat myself.
Wow, that's fantastic. So before you get into asking me questions, I'd like to just ask you, you live in Salt Lake City, you sail in the Med. How did you start this podcast Sailing in the Med that seems like an awfully random thing to do from Salt Lake City?
Well, I like audio, and I like the excuse to be able to talk to people, and I like stories. This sort of evolved. I started a podcast just called Travel Trade Exchange, which was intended to be an opportunity for people that were travelers to exchange stories. And I thought there'd be more of a demand for that, and it turned out that it was always my stories that I was telling, and all my stories had to do with sailing. And then that website got hacked, and I said, you know what, I'm not a techno guy. I'll just start another podcast, and this time I'll just concentrate on sailing in the Mediterranean. So that's how this came about.
Interesting. And so how long ago was that when you started it?
I think a couple of years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, it's hit and miss. Sometimes I do a lot of interviews, a lot of stories. Other times it's, you know, a month or two between stories.
Yeah. That's similar. It's interesting because it's similar to the way I got this podcast going. I started one that wasn't sailing related. It was just called Two Inspired Guys. And my friend and I co-hosted it. And it was just conversations with people that had made careers out of the things that they were passionate about, so that not your typical 9-to-5 type of thing. My world was sailing, of course, so a lot of the guests that I had on were sailors, and my friend Ryan, he's into sort of the arts and cooking and that kind of stuff, and he lives in Pittsburgh, so a lot of his guests were, we had a guy that went to Chicago to join Second City and try and do comedy. We had a couple of chefs on and stuff like that, and that was cool. But then Ryan was working 9 to 5, and he kind of got too busy to do it. And I was like, well, all my guests are sailors anyway, so I might as well just start a sailing specific podcast. And this is the second one that I've done as well. So interesting similarities.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in audio. I like audio, and so that's you know, some people like to do videos, and I have a few videos out there, but they just take more work than I'm willing to put into it. Audio's enough work for me. I'm looking at your bio. Now, you pretty much grew up sailing, didn't you?
Well, kind of. I mean, I did. I've sailed my entire life. My dad and mom started sailing on their honeymoon when they were in their early 20s. And kind of never looked back. And so when I was, well, actually before I was born, my dad was, I think, 28. My mom was 30. And they took a year off and took a, what the heck's the guy's name, the designer now? It was a Chesapeake 32. I'm drawing a blank. A well-known designer designed this classic Chesapeake 32. Built in Denmark, fiberglass boat, actually very similar lines to our boat, Arcturus, which is an Allied Seabreeze. Anyway, they took it down the east coast to the Bahamas, and they met a lot of people cruising with kids on that trip. So they said, well, one day when we have kids, we'd like to do this. And my mom was the very inspirational, philosophical side of the family, so she was always wanted to raise her kids, actually live aboard, and let the 9 to 5 go completely. But my dad was running a business with his brother, a family business and stuff. So they kind of mixed the two together. So we always had a sailboat on the Chesapeake that my mom and dad took me down to in the summertime. But we weren't doing any like serious offshore sailing. It was just weekends and week long trips on the Chesapeake. And then when I was 9 and my sister Katie was 7. They took us out of school for a year and did the exact same Bahamas trip that they'd done. At that time, it was an Allied Princess catch, 36-foot catch. We just went down the ICW and then spent the winter in the Bahamas and came back again. And that was my fourth grade school year. So that was kind of I tell people that was kind of the first sailing I remember as a kid, other than some things here and there when I was a little bit younger. But it was also kind of the first vivid memories I have as a human being, almost, because it was such a different, you know, I can remember specifically what it was like being a 9-year-old because I was on that trip. But if you ask me what was it like when I was 4 or 5 or 6, I couldn't pick out a specific memory from any one of those individual years because they were more or less the same, because you did school and you did summer and that kind of thing. It was the same routine. So that year on the boat really took us out of that routine, and it's like the first things I really remember specifically and vividly on a much larger level than just sailing. So that was pretty neat, and I attribute that trip to the what I've done since, like, absolutely.
You know, it's interesting. When I was in college, I had a friend that was back in the East. I was living in Indiana at the time, and I was a lifeguard at a beach, and the bacteria level rose to a point where they had to shut down the beach for a week. And I thought, well, I'm not going to sit in South Bend, Indiana for a week. I'd be bored out of my mind. Because I grew up in the Mountain West, and my father dragged me back to the Midwest to go to because he was going to Notre Dame, and I was dragged up back there for high school. So I was always a Westerner. But I thought, well, what am I going to do for a week? I'm not just going to sit around here. So I started hitchhiking, and I hitchhiked out and saw my friend who was in Charlestown, West Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I remember every ride I took. And, you know, how many days in your life do you remember every conversation you had? And I always say, well, you live at a higher level when you travel. And I think what you just described is exactly that. You were traveling. Everything was new. You remember it.
But, yep, absolutely. How old were you when you did that?
I was probably 18 years old.
Okay, yeah.
But my daughters grew up sailing, you know, when they were 5, 6 years old, we started them sailing. And so they just grew up sailing.
Whereabouts?
Well, I launched my boat up in the Northwest, up in Bellingham and I sailed up in the northwest.
And this is the boat you have now, the Channel Cutter.
Right, uh-huh.
Okay.
So we sailed up there for about 5 years, so probably between 5 or 6 and 11 years old, they were sailing up there. And then when I sailed across the Atlantic, they joined me in the Atlantic, and every summer they'd come over and spend time there. So for them, that was just normal. It wasn't until they got to late high school and college that they realized that they had a pretty unique life. And
yeah,
at
sure.
that point in time, they really realized how important that was. And I think that's a great way of raising kids. So anybody doubting it, I think they gain so much more by living on a boat and seeing things. And they're not gaining that much by going to school and studying in school. So
yeah, and we didn't miss a beat. I mean, when we came back, we left. So like the way the trip worked, we didn't leave Annapolis until after the boat show, which was like mid to late October. And so school had already started in September. So we had actually gone to school with our peers back in Pennsylvania for a month or so before they took us out of school. And then we did the homeschooling on the trip and everything. And we got back kind of in middle of, I think it was like end of April, middle of May, something like that. So we actually went back to school, but we had already completed the curriculum. So we kind of just went back to school to be with our friends and, you know, go through the motions, but just get back in the swing of things. But neither my sister nor myself missed a beat. And, you know, we were accepted right back into the school system and went on. And when I went to fifth grade the following year, my sister went to, it would have been third grade, I guess. And yeah, and we just, you know, we settled right back into it, which was pretty neat that we were able to do that and not miss anything. And of course, like you say, you know, have much, much more of just the classroom educational thing, which was really cool. And interestingly enough, part of our deal was we had to keep journals every day on the trip. And my sister was only in second grade, so, you know, she was just starting to be able to even write coherently. And we still have those journals that were handwritten, and we had to write them every day. And it's just, they're just absolute gems now to go back and read them. And I'm so, so, so glad that that was part of the deal because, you know, you're a kid. You know, that was like a homework assignment at that point. But now as an adult looking back on that, and we get out my sister's journals occasionally when we're all home at my house in Pennsylvania where we grew up and just go back and read them. And it's just a comedy show reading these because the spelling's all messed up and the way the things are. It's just, it's so, so cool that we actually did that, and I'm so grateful that we had to do that. So anybody listening that has kids, force them to write a journal whether they like it or not and just promise them that 15, 20 years later they will appreciate it.
That's exactly what we did with our daughters, and they do go back and refer to those. You know,
yeah.
They're both 28 years old, they're twin daughters, and they go back and they look at it, and they're glad they kept their notes. You know,
what do they do now, and what did they go to college for, and what kind of career paths have they chose, and has the sailing and as a kid influenced that at all?
Well, one's an occupational therapist, and the other one is a speech pathologist, and they both want to raise their kids traveling. That's really the bottom line. Now, yeah. Did my daughters really learn to sail? No, but they learned to lay out on the they learned to read. They learned to love to read. And
yeah.
that was probably the best thing is they learned to enjoy reading, because, you know, they learned a little bit of sailing, but they really weren't interested in sailing. Now, one of their husbands is very interested in sailing, and he's taken the step, and he was in Australia, in Perth, and he joined a couple racing clubs down there, and he went to the next level, and they've chartered boats on their own now. And at some point in time, I'll let them take my boat anytime they want to go and enjoy it as well.
That's so great.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm looking at a map of Sweden right now. I'm looking at mm-hmm. Google Earth. Where do you tend to sail in Sweden? Where do you like to go?
Well, I'm still discovering that, to be honest. You're going to get the long version of this answer. But so my wife, Mia, she was not a sailor before we met. She never... You know, she's seen sailboats. Sailing is a big part of the culture in Sweden, but she'd never had any friends or family that were involved in it. So before we met, she was never around sailboats. So we've had the process since we got to Sweden in 2012. It's been a learning experience for both of us to see what the Swedish sailing culture is like. And right off the bat with the language, you know, sailing is its own language. And Mia, even though she's, of course, speaks Swedish, she is Swedish, she doesn't know the sailing language in Sweden. And, of course, I don't either. I speak Swedish now fairly well, but, again, the sailing language is a different language. So, like, it was a discovery for both of us when we first got in. We came into the west coast of Sweden in a small island called Marstrand, which is outside of Gothenburg on the west coast. And that's kind of like the center of sailing on the west coast of Sweden. And going from there down around, it's 600 miles from there down around the south of Sweden and up to Stockholm in the Baltic. And, you know, we're learning how to talk on the radio and what the etiquette is, and the moorings are all different. I'm sure you had a similar experience the first time you were in the Med, because they just do things differently and you have to kind of figure that out as you go. So to answer your question now, we've been in the Baltic the last 2 years. Let me think about this. 2012 was when we first came to Sweden, and we made our way around, basically covered both coasts, the west coast from Gothenburg all the way to Stockholm, but it was like a delivery trip, so we weren't really cruising so much as just getting the boat from A to B. And then 2013, Mia's best friend is from the island of Åland, which is actually Finnish, but they're sort of independent. They have their own flag, and they speak Swedish, so it's an island archipelago basically equidistant between Sweden and Finland.
Okay, and it looks to me like spelled A-L-A-N-D, and you pronounce it O-L-A-N-D.
It's Åland. Yeah, it's actually, if you look closely, the A has a circle over the top of it, and that's a letter that they have in the Swedish alphabet that we don't have in English, which is pronounced Å, kind of like O-A together. So it's actually pronounced Åland, which is how you say it. So that's where we spent 2013. We kind of did a circumnavigation around the big island of Åland. And Mia's best friend, like I said, lives there. So we visited her parents and their summer cottage. And that was really nice, a way to explore and a place we'd always wanted to go. And then we left the boat in a town called Öregrund, which is, if you're looking at your map, if you look at Åland, you go back to the Swedish coast, and it's north of Stockholm by, I don't know, an inch or so on the map. It's kind of level with the top of Åland if you go straight across. There's a little town in called Öregrund, which is like a summer sailing stop on the east coast, and it's kind of the northern limit of cruising for most recreational sailors in Sweden. North of there, you get less and less facilities as you go up further and further into that part of the Baltic. So that was 2013, and this past year we had planned to take the boat back around to the west coast and start the voyage up the west coast of Norway, which was kind of my big dream, is to go up to the Arctic and see how far we can go up the coast of Norway. But we were enjoying the Baltic so much and the archipelago outside Stockholm last year that we actually just said, this is ridiculous. Why are we in such a hurry? So we changed our plans and sailed down to the island of Gotland, which is kind of that big island smack in the middle of the Baltic, and spent about 10 days there. I think 10 days or 2 weeks there, and visited there's a medieval town there called Visby, which is a beautiful, Gotland's a Swedish island, but beautiful medieval walled city of Visby, and really, really had a nice time there, and then came back to the archipelago outside Stockholm and kind of just bebopped our way around and enjoyed ourselves. So we didn't really go very far this past year, but we had a really, really nice time, and now the boat is hauled out in Västerås, which is on the inland lake called Mälaren, about 60 miles or so west of Stockholm, if you see it on your map there. You have to go through a lock to get there, but it's near where Mia's sister lives, so it's a nice convenient place for us to winter the boat.
Well, that's nice. So you haul out. So you're not going back and forth every year. You're doing what I do. You haul it out, and then you go back when you're ready to then. Yeah, there's a big lake there. It's a big lake, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's a very big lake, and it's really interesting how the scenery changes, because the further out you get from Stockholm in those islands, the rockier the islands get, and they get smaller and less vegetation. And the further inland you go, it's just Sweden is basically one gigantic forest. So on Lake Mälaren, all the shoreline is just pine forest, basically. And then you get out further in the archipelago, and it's rockier and rockier until ultimately the very outer archipelago is just bare rocks, which is really, really interesting how the scenery changes.
So not particularly good holding for your anchor then out in the archipelago.
Well, actually, it's very, very interesting because you don't anchoring's totally different, and this is one of the things that we had to learn when we first got over there. The beauty of the Baltic is that there's no tides, so there is also no currents. I mean, there can be wind-driven current and some weather stuff happening, but it's never anything you have to account for in your navigation. And with anchoring, the way the rocks are, the Baltic's very, very deep, but when you get towards the shoreline, it's very steep too. So the way you anchor is you actually put out a stern anchor. Well, let me back up a little bit. You find a spot to lay like along the cliffs. They call them klipporna in Swedish, but along the cliffs, the rocks. And you kind of nose your way in. And there's marked on the charts sometimes in popular anchorages where it's good to do this. But most of the time, there's just too much to even mark. So you can kind of just find your own way around. And you go in. The water's pretty clear. So you can kind of nose your way into a rock and see what's in the water. And for the most part, it's deep. It's like 10, 12 feet immediately off the shoreline. So you nose your way in, scope out a spot to go, turn around and go back out, and you drop a stern anchor. And then you pay that out as you're nosing back in towards the shore. And then usually I'll be at the helm. I'll throw the stern anchor out. We'll nose the boat in. Mia will be on the bow with a long bow line, and she'll jump ashore when I get close enough and go tie a couple bow lines to trees, or sometimes they actually have like metal rings hammered into the rocks. And you just lay alongside the cliffs like that, and you've got, I mean, the boat's about 2 feet from the shoreline, but you've got 10 feet under the keel.
Huh.
So it's really remarkable, and without any tides, you don't have to worry about the water going up or down, so you just sit tight like that, and it's just amazing. You don't even need a dinghy.
And you have really nice protection too, I guess. There's lots of islands around there, so you don't get many seas then?
Yeah, no, the archipelago is just, it's amazing sailing. It's like sailing through a maze, and it's flat water. Once you get out into the Baltic, it can get nasty sometimes, you know, because there's not much fetch, so the seas tend to be short and steep. We had a pretty rough passage going down to Gotland. It was like an overnight, maybe a 18-hour passage or so, and that was pretty nasty on the way down. But in the archipelago, it's flat calm, and it's like you can go anywhere. It's really neat.
Talk to me about hauling out your boat. Is it expensive to leave it out of the water for a year? What are the costs like? I've been in Turkey for probably 10 years, and I'm like you. I haul my boat out of the water, and it usually costs me around $3,000 a year or 3,000 euros a year for a year contract on the hard somewhere. What's it like in Sweden? I understand it's quite a bit more expensive up there.
Actually, it's the opposite. But I'd like to ask you something first. When you took your boat to the Med, did you import it and pay VAT, or how did you get around that?
No, I haven't done it, and that's why I'm in Turkey, exactly for that reason. When I sailed through, and it was in 97, the rules were that you could leave your boat in European waters for 24 months. Now, at that point in time, it was if you put your boat in bond, only what counted when you were on board really counted. So,
right, if you were storing it, it didn't count.
Right, so I'd go over for 2 months and then come back, and then go over for another 2 months and come back. And then they changed the rules so that now it doesn't matter whether you're on the boat or not. If the boat is in European waters for more than 24 months, you have to pay VAT. So for that reason, I keep my boat. Well, it used to be, well, 1 year I was in Malta, and then Malta joined the EU, and then I was in Croatia for a few years, and then Croatia joined the EU, and now about the only place that you can hide is Turkey, Tunisia, and I guess there's a couple marinas, or at least I heard of one marina in Morocco that might be a good place to do it. But other than that, I've been avoiding paying VAT. Now, Sweden is Sweden part of the EU? It's not, is it?
No, Sweden is part of the EU, but they're not on the euro. So they're kind of like England. They're in the EU, but they kept their own monetary system. And it's actually it's kind of exciting for us at the moment, because in 2015, Sweden is introducing new currency. So just redesigned and reprinted all the money, which is a very good sign that they're not planning on joining the euro either, considering what's happening. It's kind of bad for us at the moment, because we make our money in American dollars, and the Swedish crown until very recently has done very well against the dollar. Now it's starting to go the other direction. So they're in the EU, same VAT rules apply. The way we got around it was, and this is part of the reason we sailed to Sweden in 2011 when we did, is I had a residency permit in Sweden. And the rules are that if you are a resident of a country in the EU, you have 1 year from the time that your residency started to bring all of your stuff to whatever country you're resident of without paying VAT. So that stuff rule applies to cars and boats and whatever you can think of. So we actually sailed the boat. We thought we'd get it all the way to Sweden in 2011. We didn't, but it turns out it doesn't matter where you import the boat. As long as it's in the EU, it counts. So we made landfall in Ireland and then made our way up the Irish Sea and left the boat that first winter in 2011, left the boat in Bangor, which is Northern Ireland, which is actually part of the UK, which is in turn part of the EU. And they're used to people coming in on boats and doing this. So I just filed a couple pieces of paperwork. And I have a stamped letter from the Maritime Administration in the UK saying that our boat is VAT exempt, which is really, really nice because now we don't have to adhere to any of those rules. And it's as if we had actually paid the tax on the boat. The only rule was we couldn't sell the boat for at least a year. So that's already expired by now anyway. So our boat is still American flagged, but for all intents and purposes, it's now EU based, which is cool.
So how hard was it for you to get residency?
Very easy, since my relationship with Mia, actually. I think I've probably lost it since, because we've kind of came back to the U.S. and Mia now has her green card here. You can't reside in two places at the same time. But I'm in the system now in Sweden. Like, I have a driver's license and a social security number. And it was vastly easier for me to get my residency in Sweden than it was for her to get hers here in the U.S., despite the fact that we're married. It's just been she in the last 4 months, finally got her permanent green card and now is at the stage where she can apply for citizenship and in turn get an American passport. But it's been a lengthy, frustrating and expensive process. And in Sweden, it's been the opposite. I had to do a couple interviews at the embassy in Philadelphia, but it's pretty simple.
What about your taxes every year? Do you have to file Swedish taxes as well as U.S. taxes now?
Well, no. Before we got married, Mia was filing in Sweden, and I was filing in the U.S. And now that Mia is a resident and we're married, resident in the U.S., we file taxes in the U.S., and we're basically signed out of the Swedish system. So both of us have social security numbers. Sweden is the welfare state, so you have to be actually living there to get all the benefits, health insurance and taxes and stuff. So you have to, when you leave to move abroad, you've got to sign yourself out of that social security system. And so basically we're out of the Swedish system now. All we have to do when we go back, if we go back, is just sign ourselves back in. And then it'll get started again. But at the moment, we file just in America. It's interesting because the U.S. requires, if I would move to Sweden, I would still have to file a tax return in the U.S. I don't have to necessarily pay taxes, but if I can prove that I paid taxes in Sweden, I still have to file a return in the U.S., but I don't have to pay any taxes so long as the Sweden taxes were higher than what I would have owed to the U.S. So that's how I understand it anyway.
Right. Yeah, we're one of the few countries in the world that taxes your income no matter where you made it. So
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. So, but your boat is still considered VAT paid, and so you can go wherever you want in European waters without having to worry about it.
Yeah, it's great. And we're very lucky that we got that because, well, first of all, it's really expensive. In Sweden, the VAT is 25%. It's different in different countries. A lot of people will, if they're going to import their boat to Europe, will do it in the Azores because it's only 15 or 20%. But there's certain countries that the VAT is lower, so that's where you want to go if you have to actually pay the tax. But so we avoided a hefty bill when we did that. And also, since I was a resident, I think the way I understand it, and you might know differently than me since you've been doing this, but I understood it that if you're an American and you're an American boat and you go to the EU, you have 18 or 24 months or whatever. But if you're a resident of the EU on a foreign boat, that time frame is only 30 days before you have to pay VAT. So had we not been able to import the boat, I would have only had 30 days because I was a resident of an EU country. So that really wouldn't have worked. So we got lucky.
Okay. Well, there's a loophole I had never thought about, is getting residency in one of the European countries and then importing my boat at that point in time. So
yeah, that is it's an interesting thing, and it works. But to answer your original question on what it costs to keep a boat over there, it's very, very interesting, because Sweden is surrounded by water, and boating and sailing especially is kind of ingrained in the culture over there. And everybody has – I've never been to the Med, so maybe it's similar in the Med, but – people in the Baltic especially, the boats are much, much smaller. I mean, our boat's a classic 35-foot, so it's 35 feet long, but it's much smaller than a modern 35-footer. But we're inevitably one of the largest boats in most of the marinas we visit in the Baltic and the anchorage and stuff. And it's remarkable that people just have this different attitude towards sailing, where you'll see families of a couple and three young kids on a 25-footer. And they're having as much fun as, you know, the guys in the Chesapeake on their 50-footer, and probably having more fun because they're not spending as much money. And the way that you anchor up on the rocks and stuff, you're, you know, the boat can be small, but, you know, you see these families, they anchor with their bow on the rocks, and they have this whole area ashore where they set up a grill and they picnic and stuff on the shore side. So your livable area has just expanded almost infinitely, because you can, the way you can anchor, you're not stuck on the boat. So I think because of that, and this is just a hypothesis, but because of that attitude that everybody should have access to the waterfront, and that's a thing in Sweden as well. It's called, Mia, what's that law called? Allemansrätt, right? So there's a law in Sweden. I'm not sure if it's an actual law or if it's just part of the culture, but it's called Allemansrätt, and that basically gives everyone access to the countryside. So even if it's private land, you're allowed to pick berries and pick mushrooms and go hiking, and you can even camp as long as you're, I think, a few hundred meters away from a structure, and as long as you leave no trace. And that applies to the waterfront as well. So even in Stockholm, which is you know, the biggest city in Sweden, and it's a city based on all these different islands, the waterfront on every single island is public access. There's usually trails, walking or running trails around the waterfront of even the islands, the fanciest, most expensive islands downtown. There's nothing, you can't buy waterfront property because it has to be accessible to the public, which is really, really interesting and very nice, actually. So I think because of that, owning at least a small boat in Sweden is relatively inexpensive. Like, for example, where we got our boat hauled out in Västerås, we're only paying $1,100, which included the haul out, the launch, they spray the bottom off, and the whole storage for that's going to be from September through the end of July next year. So it's almost a whole year. It costs $1,100, which I think is remarkable.
That's a very good price, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. If I were to go up to sailing in Sweden, what's the nearest country that's not part of the EU? Is Finland is not part of the EU, are they?
Finland is part. Finland's EU, right, Mia? Yeah, Finland is EU. Norway is not EU, but that's not in the Baltic.
Yeah. So I guess
Mia, is there any Baltic countries that aren't EU? Yeah, I think most of the Baltic countries now are EU.
Yeah, I'm looking here: Germany, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia.
Yeah.
Finland, Sweden, yeah, you've got it pretty much
covered up. Yeah, no. I think Åland actually is not part of
actually,
the EU.
You know what? Russia's right there.
Russia's there as well, but that might be more of a headache than just being in the EU. But I think Åland Islands are not part of the EU. But I also don't know. That might be a gray area. That would be something worth looking into, though. But because I don't think they're in the EU.
Okay, so that might be it'll check into it. If I can stop in there and start the clock over every so often is what I need to do. So
yeah,
it's interesting. It looks like a beautiful, beautiful place to be sailing up there.
It is. It's. I mean, like I said, we were going to leave again last year, and we just said, no, this is stupid. We need to stay here for a while longer.
So you have a couple other things you do. Do you run a rally as well?
Yeah, so Mia and I, we are the representatives of World Cruising Club in the USA. So we cover the North American market for World Cruising Club, which is based in the UK. And World Cruising Club, the most well-known event is the ARC, the Atlantic Rally for Cruisers, which Jimmy Cornell started way back in 1986. And that's since expanded to, we have a portfolio of events around the world. The ARC, we do a return rally called ARC Europe. Mia and I are responsible for the Caribbean 1500, and also one called ARC Delmarva on the Chesapeake, and then ARC USA, which is the return of the Caribbean 1500. And then the UK office runs the big ARC. They do a six-week cruise in the Baltic called ARC Baltic. That's just started last year, actually. They do a whiskey-tasting cruise in Scotland called the Malts Cruise. And then we do a around-the-world cruise, 18 months around the world, called World ARC.
So wow.
It's a lot of events. It's a small company, but, yeah, a lot of stuff. We got the whole world covered, except aside from World ARC, we don't do anything in the Pacific. Most of the shorter events are in the Atlantic, but it's really neat. It's good fun.
Yeah, I was listening to one of your podcasts, and you were talking about, I think, the Caribbean 1500 that's coming up that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you sign people in? Do you organize them? Do you sail with them? What is your sort of responsibility when you're doing that?
Well, I got into it. I actually sailed on a couple boats in the 1500, and this was before World Cruising Club owned it. A guy called Steve Black was the founder of the 1500, and basically copied Jimmy Cornell's model. The 1500 started in 1990, and Steve Black had run it ever since. So I got on his crew on a couple boats, and that's how I kind of got into that, into doing the rally stuff. And then I skippered a couple boats in 2009 and 2010. And then when World Cruising Club bought it, they got in touch with us somehow and asked if we wanted to be event staff here and there. And it's just kind of gotten more and more ever since then. Nowadays, Mia and I are the co-event managers, and we handle, like, right even now we're starting to take signups and communicate with people that have questions and stuff. And that will continue through the summer. And then we run all aspects of the actual of delivering the event. And I'm no longer sailing. So we have like a week of stuff down in Portsmouth, Virginia that we organize. So seminars, happy hours, that kind of stuff. And then the boats go to sea. We take a few days, go back home to Pennsylvania. We're sending the weather to the fleet every day on email. And then we fly down to Tortola before the first boat arrives. And then we greet every boat on arrival with a cold rum punch and a nice welcome. And then do another week of activities and stuff in Tortola as the boats continue to arrive. And then once everyone's in, we do a prize-giving ceremony. There's a competitive part to the rally, but it's not really – that's not the point of it. But it is kind of a fun competition, and we give out fun prizes and stuff down in Tortola. So, yeah, unfortunately, I don't get to sail in that event anymore, but it's just too much work to run it and sail it at the same time, and I'd have to be on the fastest boat in the fleet. And even then, there's no guarantees that you're even going to make it as far as breaking stuff or whatever. There's always a couple of boats each year that have to turn back. But it's a good trade-off. You know, I do plenty of sailing the rest of the year, so it's kind of – I wouldn't want to run it and sail it. It would be too much to do.
I skied with one of my listeners, Dan Culpepper, who's getting ready to do a transatlantic, and he's going to be going on the ARC. So,
yeah, I was going to say, that name sounds familiar.
Yeah, he's looking forward to it. So he's getting his boat all ready. Just changed out 900 pounds of batteries in his boat. So he's getting all ready for that one.
Do you know what kind of boat he has?
He's got a Facebook page. I put a link to it, and called Headline. It's around a 50-foot boat, as I recall. It's okay. A pretty good-sized boat. And yeah. It's going to be he and his a few guys doing the transatlantic. Then their wives are going to fly over and join him once they get over there. So
cool. Yeah. So they're doing the actual ARC from Europe back to the Caribbean?
No, he's going from the United States to Europe. Isn't there one that does that one?
Yeah, that's called ARC Europe. Everything, it's kind of confusing now because over the last couple of years we've rebranded all the events with that ARC name in them, so they're all consistently branded, but it gets a little bit confusing because it's ARC Europe, it's ARC USA, it's just ARC. So yeah, ARC Europe. We have a start in Portsmouth, Virginia, and a start in Tortola. And then those two fleets meet in Bermuda and go from there to the Azores and then on to Portugal.
Now, are you working on that one as well, or have somebody else taken care of that one?
So we're not the event managers for that, but okay. We do work it. We basically work the first half. So Mia will go down to Tortola, and I'll run the start in Portsmouth, and then we'll both go to Bermuda with two other guys. The event manager is, weirdly, a British guy that lives in Hawaii now. So we're scattered all over the place. But he's the actual event manager, and he does like the planning and the registration and stuff. We're still the point of contact for all the American boats that enter the rally. So we have a little bit to do with it, but I don't do any of the planning or anything. We just work as event staff when the event's actually taking place. But then after the fleet leaves Bermuda, that's the end of our responsibility. The guy's name's Lyle. He follows the fleet to the Azores and to Portugal with one or two other staff that come from the European office.
Okay. So what are your plans? Are you going to leave your boat in Europe for quite a while then?
Yeah, I think that's the plan. We never really intended to bring it back, especially since we were able to import it over there. So I don't know. A lot's kind of happening now. This is a big year for us. I'm really busy right now with, because I only work 50% for World Cruising Club, so I've got to figure out how to make a living the rest of that time. And I've been developing some ocean passages on my dad's boat and on another boat that I've been loaned, thanks to actually a guy that I had on the podcast. His name's Merrill Brown. He's got a Shannon 43 catch that he's letting me use in February to go do some passages where crew will pay to come sailing, to come ocean sailing. So that's going really well. I've got some trips. Like I said, February's booked. I'm doing a return, bringing my dad's boat back from the Bahamas in April. That's fully booked. And then I'm taking my dad's boat from Annapolis up to Lunenburg and back in July. And that's 4 out of the 6 spots on that are booked. So that's been going really well. And that's kind of something I've always wanted to do. So that's kind of the thing that's on my mind at the moment, aside from the rally stuff. So I don't know. I have no idea where I'm going to be at this point next year, let alone in the next 5 years. But everything's going well so far. So, but yeah, our boat's going to stay in Sweden for sure.
Okay. So you're going to be supporting yourself to a certain extent by teaching other people how to sail, it sounds like, to get them comfortable with ocean cruising then.
Yeah, I'm not billing it as much instruction because I don't like to say that because that sets a different sort of expectation. Well, I'm billing it more as adventure expedition sailing, and I tell people that you will absolutely learn by osmosis, and you can learn as much or as little as you want to. So if you want to come along just for an adventure, it's going to be an awesome adventure. If you want to learn everything, you can get involved in running the boat and learn as much as you want to. But there's no formal curriculum, and it's not a sailing school. It's adventure sailing. And what I like to, the way I really like to, for people that want to learn anyway, my style is I'll kind of take a leadership role, but I'll be very hands-off on the boat, and I will sort of just be directing the crew and making sure everybody knows what they do, what they want to do. You know, I'm not going to be the one going forward to take a reef in the mainsail because there's no way to learn it unless you're actually doing it. So I'll stand back in the cockpit, have one of the crew members take the helm, have the other two guys go up forward. We'll talk through everything before to make sure everybody knows exactly what they have to do. And I'll just kind of watch. And I think it's really important to let people fail as long as they can fail safely and without hurting themselves or breaking the boat. So it's fun just to do that and let people figure stuff out on their own. But I'm still there, and they know that if I say stop, that's it, stop, and then we'll regroup. But it's really nice to do that, and it's kind of a cool thing to see what people's, you know, we get this in the rally too. You know, you get this anxiety before you go offshore, and then to see with people's transformation when they make landfall on the other end is just the coolest part of the job. It's just so much fun to see how people gain that confidence, and that's what I like the most.
That sounds like a lot of fun. How are you marketing it? Is it through your website mostly, or is it word of mouth, or what is it?
To be honest, I would really like to know where most of the people have found me. I think a lot of it comes through the podcast, actually. I've got more than half of the crew that have signed up for the passages I have in 2015 have been Canadian. A couple guys here I met at the boat show in Toronto, actually. But I think people are coming in through the podcast, and you know, I write for Sail Magazine, and I'm out there a lot doing different things, so I'm fairly easy to find. But I'm not actually marketing the passages at all. I just kind of opened it up on the website, and I've had a remarkable response to it. I kind of just wanted to see if people would be interested in doing it, and then all of a sudden, I'm almost sold out for the whole year already. So it's been a surprising response to it, because I haven't really, other than mentioning it occasionally on the podcast, I haven't really marketed it at all.
Well, that's cool. That's neat. That's neat. Yeah. I've expressed the idea of just getting a group of people together and chartering a boat, and I've got no response on that. So I've sort of quit even trying to do that, and I don't really have the time to worry about it. But you've been able to fill up a few boats. How big are these boats that you're doing this on?
Well, the one in February is a 43-foot Shannon Ketch. So I'm taking myself, a friend of mine who's coming along to be the mate, and we'll take four crew on each leg. So we're going BVI to Grenada is leg one, and then actually three of the people booked for both legs, and then I've got one guy coming down and then another guy coming back. So we'll take four on that, and then my dad's boat's a Vauquier Hood 38, so 38-foot sloop. We call it the poor man's swan because it looks like a swan. But it's not as fancy as a swan, and I'm taking three people on that just because the layout's a little bit different. So, small stuff at the moment, but we'll see where it goes.
You're at the Toronto Boat Show right now. Is that correct? Yeah. What are you doing there? Just checking it out, or do you have a booth there? What are you doing?
No, we don't have a booth. This is the first time we've come up here. We're actually here for World Cruising Club, so we're representing World Cruising Club in the rallies while we're up here. But rather than doing a booth, they have a very big seminar program here, which is a major part of the show. It's not just a sailboat show. In fact, the sailboat part of it is a very small corner of the show. It's like recreational stuff, fishing boats and power boats and ski boats and all kinds of stuff. It's a massive show. It's really neat, actually. They have in the exhibition center, they have an ice rink that they flood with water from Lake Ontario, and they actually have like water ski and wakeboard shows and stuff every day in the afternoon. It's really remarkable.
Wow.
But so I'm here. I'm on the speaking program. I've done seminars every day since Saturday, and my last one's today, actually. Sunday, I guess, we do this. We call it the Ocean Sailing Forum. And I had I was moderating it, and we had Paul and Cheryl Shard, who run the Distant Shores TV show.
Mm-hmm. I just interviewed them a couple weeks ago. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah, they're also at our they have like a speakers booth set up for us that all the speakers can kind of hang out at, so as a meeting point for people. So they've been hanging out with us the last couple days too. But they were on the panel, and then another couple, Joy and Ian Winterborn, who have a Gossard 41, and they just completed an Atlantic Circle with the rallies that we run. So they were on the panel as well, and it was like a two-hour kind of open forum discussion on all aspects of ocean sailing. And that's what we do at most of the boat shows. We do the same thing in Annapolis here, and then they do it in London and some of the UK shows. So that's kind of our thing when we go to boat shows, is try and do the educational seminar stuff rather than having – we have a booth at Annapolis, for example. But it's more fun to do the speaking stuff, and you can engage with people more than at a booth. And it's not like we're selling anything at the booth. Usually the people that we get for the rallies, we'll make contact with them at a show like this, but we won't actually see them in an event for 3 or 4 years. Because it takes such a long process to plan and buy a boat and plan your trip for this offshore sailing stuff that the lead time in a customer from the first time we make contact with them until they actually go offshore, if they even do it, is generally a very long time. But it's a neat way to get to know people.
That's interesting. You're really immersing yourself in the sailing community, which is something I don't do. I just go sailing for 2 months and then come home. But this podcast gives me an opportunity to talk to sailors like yourself and the Shards, and that's probably the reason I like to do the podcast. Now, you talked to Brian Toss not too long ago up in Port Angeles. You had a couple interviews with him. That's a standard book I have on my boat. I refer to
Yeah, he's a huge Lyle Hess fan, too. So
yeah, he is. And Larry and Lynn Party. Larry actually came down when I was building my boat and took a look at it and said,
wow.
Yeah, you're doing a decent job. He said, the problem with people that build boats is they tend to overbuild them. And he said, I'm glad you're not overbuilding them, because instead of a 3/4-inch bulkhead, they'll put a 1.5-inch bulkhead in. And
yeah.
He said, you're not doing that.
Well, that's got to make you feel good. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, yeah. He actually is the brother of one of my friends that used to live in Salt Lake. His brother used to live down here, and that's how I met him. So
really?
It's strange.
Wow. That's
small
cool.
world, isn't it?
Well, I'll tell you, the sailing world, there's not that many people, and I was going to mention this, you've got a real job, so to speak, so you said you couldn't, you couldn't find any interest to book a charter. Well, when you're in my situation and your living depends on it, you tend to work a little harder at making it happen because I don't have a job. This is it, you know, and I'm not, you know, this is definitely a lifestyle job. I mean, Mia and I are sitting in a condo right now in Toronto, and this is us. We're on the road, you know, much more than half the time. And it's great fun, but it's like there's no alternative. You either make it happen or you don't. So it's a little – the stakes are a little bit higher because I've got nothing to fall back on.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And when your back's against the wall, you work pretty hard, don't you?
Yeah. But to your point about being a small world, there's not that many people that make a living in sailing full time. So, you know, we do the rounds here between the Caribbean and the boat shows and stuff, and – it's a very, very small group of people, and it's remarkable how accessible everyone is. Even the top end racer guys, you know, the Volvo Ocean Race guys, and I've had some of them on, and I've had some. I'm actually interviewing. I don't even remember what his last name is, but his name's Derek, and he sailed the Spirit of Canada in the Vendée Globe and the Velox Five Oceans, and he's at our neighbor at the booth next to us, and he's going to be on the podcast later. But even these guys that you think of, that I think of as like hero type people, they're just normal guys, and they're happy to sit down and chat with you, and they've been very, very helpful in our careers as well. So it's really, really neat how that works out in sailing. And you've probably found it on the podcast. You just reach out to people, and they're more than happy to talk to you.
They are. Because, you know, they have stories to tell, and they're looking for their next opportunity, and you never know where your opportunities are going to be coming from. So
yeah,
maybe somebody that listened to you and said, hey, I want to talk to this person. So you never know when it's going to happen.
Yeah, that's absolutely the key. I mean, philosophically, zooming out a little bit, aside from sailing, I've always had the attitude that if you just do what you – and this totally came from my mom, but she always said, you know, do what you love and you'll figure it out. And – we've been working in sailing for like 8 years now, of doing various things, and I've never once applied for a job. Stuff just kind of happens, and you have to be open. You have to be looking out for opportunities, but when something pops up, you have to be open and willing to jump on it. And that's not just sailing. That's in anything. If you really want to pursue what you want to do, you have to be flexible enough and confident enough just to take those opportunities when they arise. And that's basically what has made us, you know, I hate to say successful because I'm just barely hanging on, but, you know, I've been having fun with it. So that's a level of success as well.
Andy, I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate time. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Yeah, I'm very curious to actually ask you a few things, if you don't mind.
No,
if you
go
have
ahead.
Some more time. I don't even know where to start now. You built this boat. I mean, how do you take – one thing I ask people all the time is how do you take these seemingly crazy ideas and take them from like this is something I really want to do to I'm actually going to do this? Because that's not a small feat to take a boat and to build it from a bare hull. What was the motivation and the inspiration behind doing that?
Well, that goes back a long time. You know, I mean, that goes back to me wanting to be a traveler, and I decided, I'm a little older than you, but I remember when I was around 15, 16 years old, Robin Graham sailed the Dove around the world, youngest kid
to sail. Yeah, also an Allied, actually.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And I just followed his travels as a kid, just dreaming of doing what he was doing. So I decided at that point in time I wanted to learn to sail, I wanted to travel by sailboat, and that never left me, you know. Now, I never grew up on the water. I'd never been on the water. I'd never even seen the ocean until I was in college. But I still wanted to do it. And I don't know what it is, and I've talked about this, but it seems to me that if you want something bad enough, there's going to be opportunities that come your way that allow you to achieve what you want. And for me, it was just so happens that a guy in my neighborhood was looking for a sailboat crew out on the Great Salt Lake. And so I learned by racing on the Great Salt Lake. Some good sized boats. Start out with a Wilderness 30, and then there was a 40 foot boat that we sailed on. Then the German Freres 60 something foot Shockwave. And so I learned to sail on decent sized boats on the Great Salt Lake, and a lot of sailing. I mean, I would sail three times a week with this guy because he was a pretty serious racing crew. And I've always told people the best way to learn to sail is on a racing crew because you make all your mistakes in a short period of time at somebody else's expense. That's my standard saying on that. So anyway, while I was doing that, I passed a six-pack, and later on I got my master's license. But I had read everything I could even before I started sailing with him. So I knew the terminology, but I didn't know anything about the actual maneuvers or anything, but I knew the terminology. And then I started building my boat. I just went and bought it, and I was doing research on the type of boats to build. And there was a guy that wrote a book called The Bear Boat, I think Frederick Mate was his name.
From a bear hull.
From a bear hull, right.
I have it on my shelf.
Okay. And I thought, well, it's just one step at a time. And I'd done a lot of construction when I was in college. Not a lot, but I helped my friends build houses and do lots of stuff. So I had no inherent skills. I think I got a D in wood shop in junior high school, so I had no real inherent skills. But I think anybody that has a desire can learn anything if they're reasonably smart. They can learn anything if they're willing to practice and try. And that's what I did. I chose this boat because I was reading, I started reading the party books, and I thought, well, this is more like the boat I want. I was looking at a Wessel, just like you did from a bear hull, but it doesn't go to windward very well. And so I chose the Bristol Channel Cutter, partly because I liked the design. I liked the traditional design, and partly because of the parties talking about it. And so I went down to Southern California, met Sam Moores, and he arranged for somebody to take me out on a boat. Guy by the name of Doug Schmuck. And Doug became a good friend of mine. I went sailing with him on his boat. His boat was named Puffin. Beautiful boat. He kept it like a museum. My boat is a sailing boat. It's not perfect. I don't spend my time varnishing my boat. I sail my boat. And so through him, I actually also met the parties too. And he came to Salt Lake and we went skiing together. And then it became just pretty much a small community. Anytime I was building my boat, I would just go down to Costa Mesa, California, go out to the shipwright that would build these boats commercially, and I'd say, now, how do you do this? And he would spend time with me and say, this is how you do this, because there's some pretty odd pieces in there. Then I'm saying, how do you cut this? How do you make this? And he would let me copy his bulkhead templates. He did everything he could to make it so I could do a good job on my boat, because I think I was one of the last hulls and decks that he sold, because there are a few people that bought the hulls and decks that didn't do a good job finishing their boat. And it sort of cheapened the whole design. So he didn't like that. So he quit. Anything he could do to help me build the boat, he did. So it took me 5 years, and I enjoyed building it. I thoroughly enjoyed building the boat. And the reason, coming back to your question, the reason I wanted to build a boat instead of buy a boat is I didn't think I'd ever be able to save up enough money to buy a boat, the kind of boat that I wanted. So,
what time frame is this that you were building the boat?
This is about, so I launched it in about 91.
Okay.
So it would have been 5 years before that, 85, 85, 86 to 91.
And you've had the same boat ever since?
I have, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's cool.
And one of those things that every now and then I think about selling it, but my daughter's saying, no, Dad, that's ours.
Nice. So did you have a schedule and a deadline, or were you just letting it run its course, the building?
No, I only worked on the boat in the winter, and I was building a summer home in the summer. My wife, part of her dream was to have a summer home up where her family has a summer home, so I was building a summer home in the summer and building my boat in the winter. And, again, it comes down to, well, even if I'd had a boat, I didn't really have the money to maintain the boat at the time. And things just sort of evolved as time went on. When I launched the boat, I was ready to launch the boat. And I guess the point is I started pretty early. I started building this boat when I was probably 25 years old. And I think I launched it when I was around 30 years old, 35 years old. How old am I now? Yeah, about 35 years old. So I started when I was 30, launched at 35. So I wasn't in a big hurry. I really enjoyed the learning that I did while building my boat. So, and I learned a lot of skills. You know, I learned woodworking. I'd start out with a big piece of teak, expensive wood, and make a mistake, and eventually I'd use something from that board that was much smaller than I started out with or intended to, and got better and better as time went on. And I learned how to fiberglass. I learned how to TIG weld. I learned how to put an engine in. I learned how to do all the wiring on the boat. So when I have a problem on the boat, it's usually pretty easy for me to fix it. So,
was it always the intent to sail it to the Mediterranean, or did that evolve after you built it?
Well, no, it was always my intention to do some sort of, well, again, my goal was to be a traveler on a boat. So,
okay. Yeah.
I spent 5 years sailing up in the Northwest, and I've told this story many times, and, you know, my goal was always to do long-distance sailing, not necessarily sailing, but I wanted to see the world on a boat, and I didn't want to just spend that time in the United States and Canada. I wanted to go overseas somewhere. So that was always my intention, and my wife was always supportive of that. But the question always is when, you know, someday, someday, someday. Well, a friend of mine, I had two very close friends growing up, and one was killed in an automobile accident, and he was went to his funeral, and they talked about all the things he wanted to do in his life. And I thought, you know, there's things I want to do in my life, and you never know if you'll have that opportunity. So that was a catalyst to make me do that year. I said to my wife, I said, well, I'm going to do it. She said, well, are we really ready for it? Maybe someday. And I said, no, it's got to be this year. We've got to start living our dreams. We can't put them off forever, because everybody puts off their dream until it's the perfect time, and it's never the perfect time. And it was the smartest thing I ever did in my life, was actually make the decision and do it. I've never been sorry. It's opened up so many opportunities. It's changed my daughter's life. It's the smartest thing I ever did. And it was just finally saying, do it now. Quit putting it off. And it was a catalyst of my friend dying that really made me actually do it. And I told my wife, I said, well, you choose which direction we go. We can go east to the Mediterranean, or we can go, you know, I didn't really want to go to the Caribbean. I wanted to go to the South Pacific, or I wanted to go to the Mediterranean. We'd chartered sailboats prior to that in both places. And we really enjoyed the culture and the diversity of the Mediterranean, and that's why we chose the Mediterranean. Not because the sailing's better. The sailing's terrible in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, I've heard.
But it's so nice to go from culture to culture to culture. And yeah. The thing I don't like about the Caribbean is every one of the places you go to was developed as a tourist resort. But in the right. Mediterranean, these were just working towns that happen to have a little tourism that show up nowadays. That's about it. They're still working towns. They're not developed for tourism. So we've been really happy in the Mediterranean. We enjoy it. But I'd like to get up to Sweden if I can just figure out how to overcome the VAT situation.
Yeah, exactly. Well, did you guys, the reason I asked you about that, your timeline is, and you answered my question, but that you, a lot of guys that build their own, maybe not a lot, but you hear stories of guys building their own boats or doing a major refit, and they just become tinkerers and never ever actually leave the dock. So I think even doing that yourself versus buying and having someone else outfit a boat kind of maybe puts you at risk for becoming that, and I think it's you know, it's neat that you actually did say, well, nope, we're gonna go, because the boat's never really ready. Our boat wasn't ready, and I'm sure yours, to some extent, you could have kept working on it. But that's really cool. How did you guys get the boat from the West Coast? Did you truck it across? Did you sail it all the way?
Yeah, we trucked it across. It had a good company, and I actually want to do an interview with a couple of the trucking companies at some point in time, and also the companies that deliver boats on ships. But we just trucked it from, well, of course, it was built behind my house in Salt Lake City, so it was trucked from my house up to Bellingham, where it was launched. Then I kept it for 5 years in Oak Harbor and Anacortes, and then you know, when I finally made the decision, then we trucked it back to my house. The trucker just left it on the trailer in my driveway, basically, and let me do a little more refitting on it, and then came by and picked it up a couple months later and hauled it to Hampton, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we launched from. That's where we launched to go do the crossing. So we went from Hampton, Virginia, straight to the Azores, which was the wrong thing to do, and paid
How
the price
that
for it.
Passage?
That was 22 days from Hampton, Virginia, to the Azores. And
what time of year did you do it?
I left April 15th, which
was a little early.
Yeah, it was early, and every low that came off the east coast of America slammed into me. So,
were you by yourself, or was your wife along?
No, I had two guys out of Elko, Nevada that were sailing with me. My wife and family, they flew over to Madrid and joined me when I got to Spain.
Okay.
But my first crew left me in the Azores. It was a really rough passage. 18 of the 22 days was in stormy weather.
Wow.
And everybody, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but most of the people that came up from Bermuda had a delightful sail.
Yeah.
And I didn't. And after that, I was very cautious, and I listened to, do you remember Herb on Southbound 2?
Uh-huh, sure.
He was giving forecasts, and I was sitting there in the Azores, Had a new crew come out and join me, Dr. Paul Bauer, who was 7 years old at the time, who befriended me in Hampton, Virginia. He came out, and another kid from St. George, Utah came out, and we had the most perfect sail from the Azores to Lagos, Portugal, that you could ever ask for. And that's just because I was waiting until Herb said it's okay to go.
Yeah, sure. Cool. Well, listen, Franz, I need to get going to the boat show, but we need to have a part two to this conversation because there's a million questions that I want to ask you, both about sailing in the Med and your own story, but also about just about podcasting in general, because there's not many of us doing a podcasting about sailing. So I'd love to talk to you some more. We need to schedule a part two for this because I got to run. But thanks for your time.
I look forward to it, Andy. Thanks a lot.
All right. We'll keep in touch.
Okay. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Thanks for listening. If you're interested in any learning to sail audio courses, take a look at my courses that are available at the website and also on Amazon for the ASA 101 course, and it's entitled Sailing! Learn to Sail Basic Keelboat Certification if you're searching for it in Amazon. Otherwise, just check it out through the website, medsailor.com. I look forward to any comments you have. Feel free to drop me a note. Thanks for listening.
Joe, you have something to tell me?
No, I don't think so.
I just got off the telephone with Bill Rutherford. Princeton can use a guy like Joe.
What?
Princeton can use a guy like Joe. His exact words.
That's unbelievable.
You're as good as in. I knew you could do it. Haven't I been telling you, every once in a while, you just got to say, what the heck, and take some chances.
You are so right.
You've made me very proud.
I was just thinking where we might be 10 years from now, you know?